Mahomes versus Russell Wilson, Chiefs versus Seahawks, two playmaking quarterbacks in very different offenses. Plus, how will the Saints deal with A.B. and Juju? What does the future hold for Jameis and Dak, and what will come first, lateral-heavy offenses or self-driving cars? It's a futuristic episode of the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. I'm Gary Gramling. He is Andy Vinoit. Week 16 is coming up. We have four headlining games to break down here, as well as the mini mailbag. And this first one, this Sunday night game, this is a good contrast in styles here with the Chiefs at Seahawks.
Yeah, I like that. And it's similar quarterbacks to a certain degree, but I think to a very specific kind of limited degree. You got two good playmaking quarterbacks is basically what you have.
Well, let's start with the home team. Let's start with the Seahawks here. Not very good offensively each of the last 2 weeks. They had special teams issues last week against the 49ers. I don't know if the offense was necessarily bad. They were bad in the victory over the Vikings on Monday night 2 weeks ago. But I mean, this is a throwback offense. This is a 90s offense, a 90s run-heavy offense here that they've built under Brian Schottenheimer.
And so what you get with that, in addition to being a run, and it is very run-oriented, and they play with six offensive linemen, George Fant, we've talked about that. He's on the field for about a third of their snaps now. What you inherently get with an offense like that is a vertical passing game. And I think that's a good way to play with Russell Wilson. Those are pretty defined reads. A lot of times they have deeper dropbacks on vertical passes, so his lack of height in the pocket's not as much of an issue. If it's not there, there's more room to break down the play and go sandlot. It's a less defined, less strict timing on the play. And then he's also a very good deep ball thrower.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's fit his skill set nicely. I think they've, you know, we wonder over the last couple of years, especially last year when they were horrific offensively down the stretch when they were playing for a playoff spot and it all fell apart. So they have done a nice job sort of finding an identity, and this would seem to be a troublesome matchup for the Chiefs defense, who, quite frankly, they struggle to tackle people.
Yeah, they're a frustrating defense to watch. I think they're one of the more predictable run defenses in the NFL. They're kind of a two-gap defense, so you get a little bit of predictability just from that because they're not having guys crisscross and shoot gaps and run blitz as much. But the Patriots are kind of a two-gap defense as well, and the difference between these two teams, at least in my mind's eye, is New England's diversifying their fronts a lot. And it doesn't feel like you get that same diversity from Kansas City. I think their personnel packages dictate how they line up a little bit more than you'd like. I just don't love their run defense overall, and it's inconsistent, and I think anyone can see that. You're right. The tackling is also just an inconsistent issue. And then is Fuller – what's the status for Kendall Fuller? I heard he broke his wrist, but then I heard he might be playing. That's a big deal. What they need him in the lineup if they're going to have any chance defensively moving forward.
I mean, it sounds like, and granted, as we always say, we tape on Wednesday night, so there will be injury news as the week goes on, but it sounded like he was going to play with the wrist injury.
Yeah, after successful surgery. Boy, that is, because, and I sprained my wrist once, actually, on the MMQB training camp trip, and I could not shake hands with everybody we met on the training camp trip the whole time. I shook left-handed at times, and I felt totally out of my element. But from what I understand of wrist injuries, they're kind of finicky, aren't they? Aren't they a little bit temperamental is probably the better word? I don't think you just have a wrist that gets hurt, you fix it, and it's healed. He's going to have to make some adjustments. That's going to take some time.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it affects your ability to do anything physical at the line of scrimmage. It's also, I remember when, this is a long time ago, this is when the Patriots beat the rookie Roethlisberger Steelers in like the 2004 season, 2005 calendar year AFC title game. The Steelers had DeShay Townsend was one of their corners, and he was playing with a broken wrist. And I remember they went after him deep a couple times, and it was kind of like, well, he can't catch the ball. So the worst-case scenario is, you know, you're not really putting it in danger anytime you have him one-on-one downfield. So they just sort of kept on going at him until they got a couple big shot plays.
Was he opposite Ike Taylor that game too? That's a couple of corners then who couldn't catch.
Poor Ike Taylor.
I love Ike Taylor.
Ike Taylor, he's a buddy.
Ike Taylor was back. When did he come in the NFL?
Oh, it would have been right around there.
I bet he was in the league then.
The Google
Ike Taylor,
machine.
2003, fourth round pick, but he didn't become a starter until I think his second season or his third season. So he maybe wasn't playing in that championship game you're talking about.
Who would have been opposite Townsend? I was a big Steelers fan back then. Chad Scott, maybe? Chad Scott got hurt that year.
Yeah, I think so. Taylor became a starter in 2005. So the guy opposite Townsend, I did not think we'd be breaking down these 0-4 Steelers so early in the show this week. but their other corner, because this kind of thing will bug me the rest of the show if we don't get this straightened out. Their other corner was Willie Williams that year.
Wow. Well, there you go. That's your preview of the 2004 Steelers, should you ever travel back in time. Yeah, this Chiefs defense, I don't know, this physical road-grading rushing attack like Seattle has, seems like it's going to be problematic. And then obviously for the Seahawks, you get that added bonus of keeping Patrick Mahomes on the sideline if you can get some sustained drives here.
Yeah, that's assuming that you can prevent Mahomes from having big plays when he's on the field, though, too. The more I watch these run-oriented teams, this is why I brought up their passing game and the vertical passing game with Seattle. The more I think your running game is only as good as the explosive pass plays it helps create. Because remember a few weeks ago, Seattle faced the Vikings. And I know they wound up winning that game, but their defense shut down Minnesota's offense completely, which you can't bank on having that happen in this game against Kansas City and Mahomes. Seattle ran the ball up and down the field on the Vikings, killed them, and they were up by, I think it's 3-0 halfway through the third quarter or something like that. The run game does not translate to points as often as we think. It does translate to time of possession and sometimes field position, but points are what matter in the NFL. So I think, yes, keep Mahomes off the field, that's all good and well, but Seattle's going to have to get some explosive plays off of their running game, too. If they have 200 yards rushing, that in and of itself is not going to win this game.
Do you want to know a really weird stat that probably means absolutely nothing, but every time I look at these numbers, it stands out to me? Seattle is third to last in the league in three-and-out drives, as in they go three-and-out more often than anyone except for the Jets and the Cardinals this year.
Well, that's because if you run the ball and you get – that gets down to how can you convert third and long, and the best way to convert third and long is to stay out of third and long. And the teams that avoid that get third and medium. They're the ones that have those drives go past three play. That does not surprise me. Who are the last two teams again?
Jets and Cardinals.
Yeah. Cardinals, and they're just a bad offense. Jets are a little bit run-oriented too.
Chiefs offense here, it's Seahawks defense has been not quite Legion of Boom era type of quality here, but they're close. I think they're a whole lot better than people expected them to be. Mahomes going against them, I mean, it's a fairly predictable defense. Is this a game where Mahomes really has a chance to go off here?
I've decided Mahomes is at that level where he can go off at any game. The Baltimore Ravens outplayed the Chiefs a few weeks ago after watching that film, and we're talking scheme to scheme. Baltimore's scheme took care of Kansas City's, and Mahomes just eradicated it and made big plays anyways, and the Chiefs won the game. So Mahomes is not someone you can predict, how do we shut him down? I do think it gets back to containing – well, I was going to say it gets back to containing the guys around Mahomes, but I think you got to have an answer for Mahomes as well. What do we do about him extending plays? And one solution you can have, and this is not consistent with how Seattle would normally play, they have done more man-to-man stuff over the last couple years versus the Legion of Boom, as you referenced, but they're not a man-to-man defense. And last year they were much more man-oriented than they are this year. But what I'm getting at is I think you could play man coverage and have a defender spy Mahomes, and a lot of teams will do that. You've got to have some kind of solution for, A, taking away Mahomes' weapons, so dealing with Kelce and Tyreek Hill, and then, B, limiting Mahomes on extending the play. And I think if you can do those two things, you're going to win. Run defense, taking care of the Chris Conley type guys in that offense, all of that is so ancillary to dealing with those superstar guys. So it's a matter of what does Seattle do to curtail Kelce and Hill, and then what do they do to limit Mahomes? Which just sounds obvious the more you say it. I guess it's easier to say than to answer the question.
It's okay to have good ideas going into a game against Mahomes. It just might not matter.
The good idea is, hey, let's stop Mahomes. I mean, that's basically what I just presented. We've got to figure out how they would do that. And it gets into the theoretical question then. These are the kind of conversations Ken Norton and Pete Carroll are probably having this week. Is, okay, we have to stop Mahomes. Is the way to do that with a guy this special, is it to do something unique for us, like that spying idea that I just proposed? Or is it to do what we do best, which makes us predictable, though, but trust that our guys can handle what we do best? And that just gets into philosophy. I would imagine Seattle would take that second option, though.
Yeah.
There are teams out there that will change their game plan for the – Green Bay, for example, I think would alter their game plan if they were facing Mahomes. I don't think Seattle's that kind of defense. I think we'll see some of the cover three stuff, and they'll hope that their guys can just play it really well.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think they just want their guys playing fast is what I would guess they would do if I knew Ken Norton and Pete Carroll here. Let's go Steelers at Saints late afternoon Sunday game. Let's start with the Saints offense before we talk about the actual matchup. This offense has, we saw the Thursday night a couple weeks ago. They put up 10 points at Dallas. They only put up 12 points at Carolina on Monday night this past week. Granted, it's been three straight road games, and we have seen, if you're looking at the full body of Drew Brees' career, he's always been a little bit better in the Superdome than elsewhere. But is there something inherently wrong with this offense at this point? Relatively speaking, of course, because they're still good.
Yeah, they're still good. They're absolutely still good. They're not as good as they were, though. Let's put it this way. They haven't been playing as well as they were.
Yeah.
I think some sneaky big news that came out today is they designated Ted Ginn as the guy to return from injured reserve. And what has stood out on film with the Saints the last few weeks is that they're not threatening defenses downfield anymore. Traquan Smith, who we had high hopes for, their third-round rookie receiver, and when he does show flashes, they're pretty intriguing flashes. He has not become that vertical prowess guy, though. Ginn would give them that dimension, the ability to stretch the field and then build your route combinations accordingly. So stretching the field doesn't just mean running deep and throwing deep. It means presenting routes based off of those deep, influencing safeties and then throwing at the 15 to 25-yard range.
Yeah.
That's where Michael Thomas can be very dangerous. We haven't seen that dimension as much with the Saints. I don't know if Ginn will be back this week or if it's going to take him a little bit more time, but they've got to start threatening teams downfield again. They've become a very condensed passing game.
So they have the Steelers coming to town this week. We saw a couple Sunday nights ago when the Chargers beat the Steelers, and what they did in the second half was that they got all these against Steelers zone coverage. They got Keenan Allen running against linebackers constantly. I don't know. I mean, do the Steelers sit in zone again, considering they would have trouble matching up their linebackers on an Alvin Kamara in the passing game? Or what do they ultimately do here? And is this a game where you can sort of Michael Thomas's ability to be a chess piece is just the kind of thing that would give the Steelers fits?
Yeah, it would a little bit, because the Steelers don't travel their corners into the slot, and Michael Thomas lines up into the slot quite a bit. The Chargers and Saints are pretty similar if you look at their personnel and the type of quarterbacks running the show. Rivers and Breeze are very similar. Anticipation passers, outside, inside, intermediate level throwers. You have Eckler as the Kamara for the Chargers, and then the Chargers, Keenan Allen's Michael Thomas, and actually LA's receiving corps a little bit better than New Orleans, but the chess pieces are similar there. So I would think the Steelers would want to in theory, defend the Chargers the way that, or defend the Saints the way they defended the Chargers. The question is, now that they know that it didn't work so well, if they had to play the Chargers again, for example, would they defend them differently? And is that what we'll see them do to the Saints? And I don't know the answer. My sense is they'll play some more matchup stuff than they did against the Chargers. Seems like that's what they go to when they get a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah, this is, I don't know. I feel like this is one where the Saints maybe return to that, you know, what they did to the Rams or what they did to the Eagles or you know, all these 40-something point games they were putting up earlier in the year. I think they have a chance to maybe get back to that.
Those are worse defenses in Pittsburgh, let's remember.
They are. The Steelers team has had some issues matching up with the opposing passing games, though. They do have a pass rush that can make a difference when it's on, though, so we'll see. They'll have to be up to the task this week. Steelers offensively versus the Saints defense might be James Conner might or might not be back. It's unclear at the moment. Again, we tape on Wednesday night. What was your impression of Jalen Samuels? Because I can tell you at NC State, Jalen Samuels was a Swiss Army knife guy, but I don't think anyone really saw him as a workhorse running back. I mean, he was a guy who lined up at a little bit of receiver, a little bit of tight end, a little bit of H-back, and also played a little bit of tailback, but was not necessarily a master of the run game.
No, he's not, but they won't need him to be that anyway. I mean, there's not enough touches to go around for Samuels to be that kind of guy. I liked him, all right. They ran that counter trace stuff with him last week against New England, and he had some success on that. It was a toss counter, I guess. It wasn't counter trace, but they were tossing him the ball and misdirection runs. What's interesting with the Steelers is every week they go into a game with one or two, and usually it's only about one, really specific runs that they're going to feature. Some weeks, like last week, is that toss counter. Some weeks, it's lead strong. I remember against the Bengals, they killed them out of lead strong runs, just straight handoffs with a fullback blocking. Other weeks, it's inside zone. It's kind of, there's always one defining run for the Steelers based on each week's opponent and how well that Samuels fits that run, and that's going to be a big factor, or if it's Connor in there, whatever it is, how well they do with that one defined run usually determines how well their running game operates.
How do you think the Saints match up with a weapon? So I think we were both caught off guard a little bit last week when it ended up Patriots played J.C. Jackson on Juju Smith-Schuster, and they had Gilmore running with Antonio Brown a little bit. Obviously, you have two unique cover corners there in Marshawn Lattimore, who's the number one, and Eli Apple is number two. How do you expect them to match up with the Steelers receivers, most notably the two star receivers?
Yeah, that's the key. Dennis Allen, their D coordinator for New Orleans, he will play double teams on guys. He'll dedicate doubles. In fact, I don't remember if Allen was there actually when they did this, but there was one time that the Saints, Sean Payton certainly was there, where the Saints played, when they played the Texans a few years ago, they dedicated a double on DeAndre Hopkins with their free safety. So they basically played cover zero everywhere and had no safety anywhere because they were doubling Hopkins with the free. They're not going to let superstar receivers beat them. That's why they traded for Apple. That's why they drafted Lattimore in the first round last year. They don't want to get beat by superstar receivers. So now it's just a question of, okay, how are they going to match up to this Smith-Schuster and Brown? You got to take them both out. That's what's made Pittsburgh so potent, is they now have two high-level star wideouts. If it's me, it's a question of Eli Apple. That's a guy Roethlisberger is going to pick on. So how do we hide him, and do we feel best? I would think you'd put him on Brown, because then you dedicate a safety on that help right there. So it's Apple with a safety doubling Brown, and let's try our luck with Lattimore against the young guy Smith-Schuster there.
It's going to be interesting.
Because if you give Apple help, what they want him to do is be a press corner. And when he's comfortable, he does that. When he's uncomfortable, he's more of a mirroring read and react, and very emphasis on the react part there. Yeah. He's that kind of corner. You don't want him playing that way against Antonio Brown. You want him being pressed and physical. If you put a safety over the top of him, you're going to get that from him.
It's good. It's always a good test to see teams go against the Steelers here, since you have to deal with two superstar receivers. And look, we might have seen the start of bigger things for J.C. Jackson in New England last week. Maybe Eli Apple has a similar performance, and we are optimistic on him.
Where do you think Smith-Schuster ranks in the NFL right now among all receivers?
That's a really good question.
Is he over or under Adam Thielen?
I think he's under Adam Thielen.
Okay, and I don't think I disagree with that.
He's top 10, I'll say that. I mean, when we've done the ranking shows in the offseason, it's always been the three. It's been Brown, Beckham, Julio, and then it's been sort of, DeAndre Hopkins, Thielen. You might put him right after that. Am I forgetting someone obvious?
Well, statistically...
Oh, Michael Thomas.
Yeah, Michael Thomas. So here are the leading receivers in the NFL. Boy, I'll start at 10 and go backwards. Number 10 in the league for receiving yards is George Kittle, who's not even a wide receiver. He's a tight end, of course. George Kittle's having quite a season. Kelsey's...
He had quite a half that game a couple weeks ago where he had like
Denver,
210 yards in the first half.
And almost all of them came on three-level stretches, by the way. The high-low concepts that out-leverage a defense. The Niners are great at it. But number 8 is Thielen in receiving yards this year. 7 is Thomas, who's pretty much got the same as Thielen. Smith-Schuster is 6. They're all around 1,275-ish there. And then Tyreek Hill at 1,300 yards. Devontae Adams about 1,300. DeAndre Hopkins. Then Mike Evans is right above him. Then Julio Jones, who's... I thought he was having a quiet year, but I guess he's leading the league in receiving by a wide margin, actually. He's behind Julio, certainly. He's behind Hopkins. He's behind Tyreek Hill. Is he behind Hill, you think, Smith-Schuster?
It's so weird to say because they're such different players.
They're so different, yeah.
Honestly, just because I feel like there's no one like Tyreek Hill. I feel like we will talk about other guys who are like Smith-Schuster. I think I'd take Tyreek Hill if I were starting a team, just because you can't really duplicate that.
Okay. Thielen, if we'd had this conversation a few weeks ago, I would have said, oh, Thielen, that's a no-brainer. He's slowed down just a little bit, though, and the offense around him has slowed down. That's part of it, I know. I've heard some close to the Vikings say they think Stephon Diggs is actually the better player of those two, even though it's not reflected in the numbers.
I don't know. To me, you're just
Hollywood Brown. Maybe start there. Who's the Steelers' best receiver, first of all? This is what defenses have to figure out. The difference is defenses can roll a safety over someone. You and I are trying to figure this out just head-to-head.
I still think it's Antonio Brown.
I do, too. I think Smith-Schuster is gaining a lot faster than I would have guessed, though.
I'd put and obviously, go. I mean, we'll do this in the offseason when we do the ranking shows. I think Smith-Schuster is somewhere in that, let's call it the second tier with, Thielen, probably Keenan Allen you'd put in that group. Mm-hmm. Smith-Schuster, Devontae Adams.
We got to talk. I mean, Beckham is first tier, I assume.
I think Beckham's first tier. It's a different conversation if you're factoring durability, but when he's healthy, he's first tier.
So real quick, what makes Smith-Schuster so good and why we're having this conversation? He is an incredible contested catch guy. He doesn't quite look it because he lets the ball come to him a little bit. But he's a very good contested catch guy, incredible contested catch guy. He uncovers against zone coverage over the middle of the field very well. So he's got a sense of spacing, and I think he's faster than he appears.
Yeah, I will say that about him. I did not think he played particularly fast at USC, and suddenly he looks he's not a burner. He's not Tyreek Hill, but he is fast. He is certainly fast enough for the NFL level. Let's go to the next one here. Let's go Bucks at Cowboys, and let's start with the Cowboys offense coming off a week where they were shut out, and Zach Martin probably shaping up to be questionable. He did not practice on Wednesday, so maybe they hold him out again just to make sure he is healthy for the postseason. Not that they should count their chickens just yet, but they probably feel pretty good about getting there. But I don't know. Is there anything you see from this offense that makes you think last week was just not one of those days for them. I mean, it's not a great offense, but it's certainly an offense that's moved into the realm of mediocre, considering the eliteness of the running game and then the fact that they have enough to get by weapon-wise in the passing game at this point.
Yeah. Well, we talked about the Colts defensive coordinator, Matt Eberflus, having been around the Cowboys for a number of years, and what does he know about Dak Prescott that others might not know? And I thought the game was very telling from Indianapolis. They're a traditional zone-based defense, much like the Buccaneers are, in fact. And against Dallas, they came out blitzing, guns blazing. They did it all game long. It was blitz after blitz after blitz, fire zone, so they played zone coverage behind the blitz. Really diverse looks, came off the edge in the slot. So what that tells me is Eberflus felt that you want to make Dak Prescott have to play quickly and make quick decisions. Prescott's a little bit methodical, Gary. And remember his rookie year, we said, well, he had such perfect conditions. He got to hang back in the pocket all game long. He handed it off. They did rollouts with him a lot off the handoffs. All of those were slow developing plays. So do you try to make Prescott play fast? Because the more I watch him, and this is probably a whole separate conversation, the more I think he's an average quarterback with a lower ceiling than I would have guessed after his rookie season. He's not a very mechanically sound passer. He doesn't have an amazing arm. He is mobile, and he's good at using the mobility. But as just a pure passer, I think he's got limitations. And if you can dictate the game defensively, I think those limitations get exposed.
Let's have another Jameis Winston conversation, which we haven't had in a while. I think he was benched the last time we talked about
him. Yeah, it's been a long time.
The Bucs problem when they hit that midseason slump, not that they've really broken out of it, but they were turning the ball over constantly. They had four turnovers in a four times in a five game stretch here from late October to mid November here. They've only turned it over three times in the last 4 weeks and no games with multiple turnovers. They were leading the Saints in the second half. They let that one get away from them. They had some special teams problems. And they were in that game at Baltimore, ended up winning it by eight, but it was a one-possession game pretty much the entire way. Is he on the cusp, let's say, of playing himself into the Bucs plans for 2019? And I guess it's a bit of a different question this year because last year we had the five first round quarterbacks, we had Kirk Cousins, we had Case Keenum, there were options. I don't think there are very good options out there this year.
No, I don't either. I do think there's going to be a little bit of a PR issue with this. Do they feel that the Cutter Winston marriage? If they think that doesn't fill the stadium in Tampa anymore, which I would guess it probably does, it's not a sexy marriage for fans to observe now. Is that factor in? Do you think that would factor into that decision?
I guess even taking that out, do you think this Dirk Cutter offense is right for Jameis Winston?
I think it's the best chance Winston will have because what Winston does best is he throws tight windows at the deep intermediate levels. He pulls the trigger. Now, my concern with Winston, and I know you said they haven't had as many turnovers lately, when you put on the film, what finally dawned on me a couple of weeks ago, I forget who he is. It's either the Carolina game or the New Orleans game. Week 13 was Carolina. Week 14, the first New Orleans game. Then they played him a few weeks ago. But he has a lot of near turnovers. And what I'm starting to think is his turnovers and the number of interceptions is just a function of how many times the opponent happens to catch the ball that week. He's going to throw five or six balls that are catchable for defenders, and whether the defenders connect or not, that decides how good of a game Winston's had on paper, or really the Bucs have had, because when he does throw those picks, they get beat. When he doesn't, they don't. The decision-making is still erratic at times. His command is erratic at times. I love him. I love his positives. The problem is you don't know if you're getting the positive or the negative on any given snap, and there have been several games where it's looked very positive from afar, and then when you squint, you see that, it very well could have been negative, and it wasn't.
Well, that's a pessimistic way to wrap up this one.
Yeah, well, that's a hard – and what's interesting, not to try to drag Prescott back into us because we can have that discussion in the offseason, with his contract coming up, let's say they don't sign Prescott anytime soon. Let's say they kick that can down the road a little bit, which I think they should. We might be having these Winston kind of conversations with Prescott next year. I think that's a story looming in the shadows.
That's going to be really interesting because they have to figure out what they're doing with Ezekiel too, and Amari Cooper, obviously.
And I don't think they can let Elliott get away. There aren't many running backs that I would say that about. I mean, there might be four or five in the whole NFL. And after those four or five, then I think to some degree they're all the same. But those top four or five, and Elliott's one of them, I don't think you can let him get away. I would, if given the choice between signing Elliott long-term or Prescott long-term, when we factor in what each guy will cost, I would absolutely take Elliott and let Prescott walk. If they were the same cost, they were both $15 million a year, which is probably what Elliott will cost, maybe $20 million a little bit. So, you know, if they were around there, then it's a harder conversation. But I'm not paying Dak Prescott $28 million a year for 5 years.
Yeah.
Would you?
Might be close to the going rate. Maybe not quite, but...
Yeah, I know. That's why it's going to be an interesting conversation. But would you pay him? Let me add this in. Hold on. Let me add this in, too, now, since you paused so long. Since you're so ill-prepared here. Their defense is very young. So they're going to have some important contracts to sign there. Byron Jones, DeMarcus Lawrence, he's already up on a franchise tag this year. Yeah, Jalen Smith, Leighton Vander Esch, pretty far down the road, but not as far down the road as you think. They've got some young stars on defense that they have to make decisions about. So a powerful offensive line, dominant running back, young stars on defense. I don't you tell me if you're spending for a big quarterback there.
Can I give you just a gut feeling on what I think is going to happen? I think he's going to take below market.
You think Prescott will take below market?
I think he'll take below market. I think he will.
Wow, but I don't know. He's already playing. He's been playing below market. He was a fourth round pick. So I mean, he's been playing way below market. I don't think. I would imagine there'd be pressure from even other QBs and agents and the NFLPA. Tacitly to not do that if it were him, especially with it being Jerry Jones.
I was just saying, I think he plays below market like a Tom Brady contract.
Well, Tom Brady has different circumstances than Dak Prescott does.
It would be fascinating. The short answer to your question is no. I would not give him. And I don't. You know, he wouldn't top Aaron Rodgers or anything like that. I don't think he'd be the number one guy. I don't think he's in that class, but I wouldn't pay him in the high 20s. And I think there's something to be said for how many teams around the league are looking at him and kind of thinking, well, yeah, he was great as a rookie, and he slid back, or maybe not even slid back, but just not progressed the way you'd like to see him progress. And when he was a rookie, he had the all-world offensive line. He had Dez Bryant was still a number one receiver. He had Witten. He was in the perfect circumstance. So if you're another team, I don't know. Are you chasing him? And then from Dak's perspective, I mean, you're the Cowboys quarterback. If you're the Cowboys quarterback, you will get opportunities that you wouldn't get if you are the Jaguars quarterback.
Marketing opportunities?
Marketing opportunity standpoint, yes.
Yeah, maybe until everybody starts thinking you're average. I don't know. I don't know if that's as true as you. I don't remember Quincy Carter ever becoming a poster child for anybody.
Well, no, but he's not going to be Quincy
better than
Carter.
Quincy Carter was. Dak's better than Quincy Carter, but he's, you know what? He's Dak Prescott's closer to Quincy Carter on the scale than he is to where Tony Romo was.
I don't know, that's a weird scale.
He's closer to
that
John.
A weird scale.
Well, yeah, it's a wildly it's a wild scale. But I don't think Prescott's special, I guess is what I'm getting at. Carter's pretty limited, so maybe I need to scale that back a little bit, but
I'll just say this from Dak's perspective. Dak is a we're not even or at least I stopped breaking down football. Dak's a capable spokesperson. Like he does what the Campbell's chunky soup. He does stuff like that. You can
not,
you know,
only is he capable. I think he's desirable.
Yes, and that's
absolutely.
That's the difference between him being the Dallas Cowboys quarterback and him being the Jacksonville Jaguars quarterback. Even if he went to Jacksonville and you know was an above average quarterback and you know won 9 to 11 games every year, you know those are opportunities that don't come to him there.
I guess Jacksonville's an extreme example though too.
Yeah,
like,
but
Baker Mayfield, for example, is going to become a big endorsement guy soon, and Cleveland's not a mega market. Aaron Rodgers in Green Bay. Green Bay's a little bit of an exception because they're a national brand, but Pittsburgh,
well, who
national
do you want to
brand,
say?
I
how
guess.
About how about like Minnesota? How about a mid-market team?
Well, how about this? Patrick Mahomes.
Yeah.
I think he could be the number one grossing pitch man of quarterbacks.
You might be right.
One day.
This has become a really strange conversation for our Cowboys Bucks preview. But that's my gut feeling is that Dak is going to take less than not maybe not significantly less, but less than what people think he might get. He also just seems to like playing for the Joneses. Isn't that a feeling you get?
Well, yeah, but we'll see how he does if they ask him to take less, how much he likes playing for him then.
All right.
I do get that feeling, though, and I get the feeling they like him as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's do one more game here. Let's go back in time to Saturday night. Well, that's still in the future, but it's back from the Sunday games we just discussed. Ravens at Chargers. This is look, we've talked a lot of Ravens defense here. They gave up points to Patrick Mahomes. We've covered that. No one's really gotten him. I mean, Panthers got him for 36 points, although that was a game where they scored some points on turnovers. They gave up 34 to the Bengals, a big first half when C.J. Mosley got hurt in-game on a Thursday, so that was a quick turnaround. But no one's really gotten him. Phillip Rivers is a bit of a different case here. I mean, it seems like he would be the kind of guy who can handle sort of an expansive defense coming at him here.
Yeah, perhaps. What Baltimore will do is show him a pressure look and then bring a pressure, but it'll be slightly different than the look they showed him. And they'll play three deep, three under coverage behind it, so six-man zone coverage. The zones will wind up playing out a lot like man-to-man, but you won't necessarily be able to get into some of your man-beater concepts that the Chargers are so good at because it's not man that you're trying to beat. It still is a zone structure. It's a hard defense to deal with. Most teams, a lot of them can't do it, but the Ravens have cover corners. They've got versatile safeties, and they have a well-coached defensive line, and Terrell Suggs, I think, still headlines that, and he's as smart as anybody in the NFL. So that's the Ravens formula, and Rivers is a field general who runs the game at the line of scrimmage, has an expansive offense. It's going to be a fun one to watch. The pre-snap phase of this will be a lot of fun. And remember, the guy running the show on the field for the Ravens is Eric Weddle, who has faced Phillip Rivers in practice for a number of years when Weddle was a Charger.
Oh, that's a good point. I hadn't even thought of that, actually.
I just thought of it at the end of my little spiel there.
That'll be a lot of fun. And I do want to remind people, if you do want to get a sense of what Phillip Rivers does in the pre-snap, you can go back to Andy's excellent article from this previous summer, The Mind of Phillip Rivers Explaining the Game Within the Game. Very enlightening if this is your kind of thing, which it probably is if you're listening to the show. Keenan Allen, we should mention, returned to a limited practice on Wednesday, so maybe they'll have him back, so they'll have their full weaponry. But let's go to that Ravens offense versus this Chargers defense. You know, it's Gus Bradley. It's that Seahawks style defense. It's a little bit more predictable. They're fast flowing. I mean, that seems to be a fast flowing reactionary defense like this seems to be a bad matchup for this Lamar Jackson and all the misdirection they have in the run game here.
It could. One thing, though, is the Chargers, I want to say, they've been pretty good at dealing with read option, which is where a lot of this stuff begins. Melvin Ingram's a pretty good read option. In fact, he's a very good read option defender. I didn't think he deserved to be in the Pro Bowl this year, but as a read option defender, Melvin Ingram's one of the best in the NFL. Now, you could always run the read option to Bosa's side. You know, Bosa plays the strong side, Ingram plays the weak side. I'm sure the Ravens will do both. They'll diversify. I kind of like the Chargers' chances in this one. Even though they're not a great run defense, the Ravens aren't a great running offense either. What they are is a very well-schemed, diverse running offense. Yeah. So if you can counter some of that diversity, Baltimore's not going to out-execute you. So you've got to find a way to not let them out-scheme you. Adrian Phillips at linebacker, who is a safety, but he plays linebacker in their sub-package. Derwin James, Melvin Ingram, Joey Bosa, those athletes, those are the key guys. And what can they do? And can they make flash plays that force you into second and long, third down, where now Jackson has to pass? That's where the game will be decided.
Yeah, just it's interesting. Ravens having to go on a one-day short, but a short week nonetheless, traveling across the country here to face a well-rested Chargers team here, and obviously a big game for both teams here. Andy, I think we have time for a mailbag question.
Okay.
Is that okay?
You're just doing one? That's a lot of pressure on this question.
Just one. We have one from Paul here, which I'll actually save for next week because I think it's something that we can sort of look forward to the postseason and answer it that way. But this is from David, and this one also we should answer now because otherwise it's going to become outdated. David asks, watching and thinking about the last play of Miami versus New England and all the laterals used, I was wondering why coaches don't draw up more plays using laterals. Offensive skill players should have excellent ball handling skills, so they should be able to cope with lateral passes, and it adds dimension, which is more difficult to defend against. I'll just add real quick, Andy. You know, if you're like the Jaguars right now with Cody Kessler under center, it's like, I mean, granted, they're not going to add it midseason, but, you know, if you have a quarterback like that, isn't this something you consider, something out of the box like this? Is this going to be like the next, you know, the next phase of sort of, you know, new fun football?
Yeah, I think this is where football will be in 30 or 40 years. I remember tweeting that. The Rams did it last year a few times, some designed laterals. Cooper Kupp was involved, I want to say. I remember tweeting one of the videos saying this will be football 25, 30 years from now. Because the game has to go somewhere schematically. It has to, and that's just the inevitable next place. Now, I don't know, it's next place being several places from now, not the very next place. So I think Dave's on to something. David is on to something here, but he's on to something. It's a race between laterals and self-driving cars, let's put it that way, for what we're going to see mainstream next.
None of us will be alive to see this happen, David. I'm sorry.
I worry about that with self-driving car. I get so frustrated at the limitations of the human brain. I'm part of it. I'm a good driver, but I make dumb mistakes like any driver, and they frustrate me to no end, especially when other people make them in front of me. And so I am rooting hard for self-driving cars, and I fear that they're going to come out the day after I die.
Oh,
which I hope is many years from now. I'm not rooting the car part I'm thinking about here, not my demise.
I can't wait to take that self-driving car to your funeral. Not that I want to go to your funeral, but you know what I'm saying.
You're assuming you'll be around still.
No, I don't think I want to.
You are much,
I don't think I want to,
much older than me.
I eat a lot of Clif Bars, though, so I'm in really good health. I don't think I want to do the self-driving cars. Only when I'm like drunk and you know, it's substituting for an Uber. I like driving.
No, we're going to look back one day and be mesmerized that human beings ever drove themselves around, thinking, man, can you believe how stupid they were? How did they think they could handle that? I hope it's mandated that everything's a self-driving car. It will be one day. Humans are too stupid.
Well, I'm not. I should have a license. They should just make licenses harder to get.
That I agree with, but you know what? They never will, because that would weed out the old people first, and that's who goes to the polls every Tuesday of November that they do. You know, that's who votes. Old people vote. We don't vote.
Car manufacturers probably wouldn't be thrilled either if they were Nobody driving out
but
there.
But you're right. Once you turn 70, 75, however old the oldest guy at SI is, the guy in charge, add 10 years onto his life, so I'm just being safe here when I say this. But once you get that age, you ought to have to take a driving test every 10 minutes.
That's all right. I don't know if that's realistic policy, but I like the sentiment. I think that's going to do it. Laterals and self-driving cars, something to look forward to after we're all gone. Thanks to our researchers, Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor, who make us sound smart. And thank you, as always, to producer Shelby Royston and the guys in Cadence 13, who make us sound good. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB Deep Dive Podcast. You are the best. Andy and I will be back in your feed first thing Monday morning, break down all the Sunday action. I will be back on Friday joining Jimmy Traina and Scott Gramling on the MMQB Gambling Show. If you go back one in your feed, you'll get Jenny Bretis and Connor Orr joining Albert Breer, breaking down the big news from around the league. We ask that you subscribe to the MMQB Podcast Network wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, radio.com/10things, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys on Monday morning.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.